The Abdication. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Speech given by Winston Churchill to the House of Commons, 10th December, 1935. Nothing is more certain or more obvious than that recrimination or controversy at this time would be not only useless, but harmful and wrong. What is done is done. What has been done or left undone belongs to history, and to history, so far as I am concerned, it shall be left. I will, therefore, make two observations only. The first is this. It is clear from what we have been told this afternoon that there was at no time any constitutional issue between the King and his ministers, or between the King and Parliament. The supremacy of Parliament over the Crown, the duty of the Sovereign to act in accordance with the advice of his ministers, neither of those was ever at any moment in question. Supporting my right honourable friend, the leader of the Liberal Party, I venture to say that no Sovereign has ever conformed more strictly or more faithfully to the letter and spirit of the Constitution than his present Majesty. In fact, he has voluntarily made a sacrifice for the peace and strength of his realm, which goes far beyond the bounds required by the law and the Constitution. That is my first observation. My second is this. I have, throughout, pleaded for time. Anyone can see how grave would have been the evils of protracted controversy. On the other hand, it was, in my view, our duty to endure these evils even at serious inconvenience, if there was any hope that time would bring a solution. Whether there was any hope or not is a mystery which, at the present time, it is impossible to resolve. Time was also important from another point of view. It was essential that there should be no room for aspersions, after the event, that the King had been hurried in his decision. I believe that, if this decision had been taken last week, it could not have been declared that it was an unhurried decision, so far as the King himself was concerned, but now I accept wholeheartedly what the Prime Minister has proved, namely, that the decision taken this week has been taken by His Majesty freely, voluntarily, and spontaneously, in his own time and in his own way. As I have been looking at this matter, as is well known, from an angle different from that of most honourable members, I thought it my duty to place this fact also upon record. That is all I have to say upon the disputable part of this matter, but I hope the House will bear with me for a minute or two, because it was my duty as Home Secretary, more than a quarter of a century ago, to stand beside His present Majesty and proclaim his style and titles at his investiture as Prince of Wales, amid the sunlit battlements of Carnarvon Castle, and ever since then he has honoured me here, and also in wartime, with his personal kindness and, I may even say, friendship. I should have been ashamed if, in my independent and unofficial position, I had not cast about for every lawful means, even the most forlorn, to keep him on the throne of his fathers, to which he only recently succeeded, amid the hopes and prayers of all. In this prince there were discerned qualities of courage, of simplicity, of sympathy, and above all of sincerity, qualities rare and precious which might have made his reign glorious in the annals of this ancient monarchy. It is the acme of tragedy that these very virtues should, in the private sphere, have led only to this melancholy and bitter conclusion. But although our hopes today are withered, still I will assert that his personality will not go down uncherished to future ages, that it will be particularly remembered in the homes of his poorer subjects, and that they will ever wish from the bottom of their hearts for his private peace and happiness, and for the happiness of those who are dear to him. I must say one word more, and I say it specially to those here and out of doors, and do not underrate their numbers, who are most poignantly afflicted by what has occurred. Danger gathers upon our path. We cannot afford, we have no right to look back. We must look forward. We must obey the exhortation of the Prime Minister to look forward. The stronger the advocate of monarchical principle a man may be, the more zealously must he now endeavour to fortify the throne, and to give to His Majesty's successor that strength which can only come from the love of a united nation and empire. End of speech. Read by Kara Schallenberg on June 29, 2008, in San Diego, California.
The Locust Years, 1936. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Ruth Golding. Speech given by Winston Churchill to the House of Commons, 12th of November, 1936. I have, with some friends, put an amendment on the paper. It is the same as the amendment which I submitted 2 years ago, and I have put it in exactly the same terms, because I thought it would be a good thing to remind the House of what has happened in these 2 years. Our amendment in November 1934 was the culmination of a long series of efforts by private members and by the Conservative Party in the country to warn His Majesty's Government of the dangers to Europe and to this country which were coming upon us through the vast process of German rearmament, then already in full swing. The speech which I made on that occasion was much censured as being alarmist by leading Conservative newspapers, and I remember that Mr. Lloyd George congratulated the Prime Minister, who was then Lord President, on having so satisfactorily demolished my extravagant fears. What would have been said, I wonder, if I could 2 years ago have forecast to the House the actual course of events? Suppose we had then been told that Germany would spend for 2 years £800 million a year upon warlike preparations, that her industries would be organised for war as the industries of no country have ever been, that by breaking all treaty engagements she would create a gigantic air force and an army based on universal compulsory service, which by the present time, in 1936, amounts to upwards of 39 divisions of highly equipped troops, including mechanised divisions of almost unmeasured strength, and that behind all this there lay millions of armed and trained men for whom the formations and equipment are rapidly being prepared to form another 80 divisions in addition to those already perfected. Suppose we had then known that by now 2 years of compulsory military service would be the rule, with a preliminary year of training in labour camps, that the Rhineland would be occupied by powerful forces and fortified with great skill, and that Germany would be building, with our approval, signified by treaty, a large submarine fleet. Suppose we had also been able to foresee the degeneration of the foreign situation, our quarrel with Italy, the Italo-German Association, the Belgian declaration about neutrality, which, if the worst interpretation of it proves to be true, so greatly affects the security of this country, and the disarray of the smaller powers of Central Europe. Suppose all that had been forecast, why, no one would have believed in the truth of such a nightmare tale. Yet just 2 years have gone by, and we see it all in broad daylight. Where shall we be this time 2 years? I hesitate now to predict. Let me say, however, that I will not accept the mood of panic or of despair. There is another side, a side which deserves our study, and can be studied without derogating in any way from the urgency which ought to animate our military preparations. The British Navy is, and will continue to be, incomparably the strongest in Europe. The French army will certainly be, for a good many months to come, at least equal in numbers and superior in maturity to the German army. The British and French air forces together are a very different proposition from either of those forces considered separately. While no one can prophesy, it seems to me that the Western democracies, provided they are knit closely together, would be tolerably safe for a considerable number of months ahead. No one can say to a month or two, or even a quarter or two, how long this period of comparative equipoise will last, but it seems certain that during the year 1937 the German army will become more numerous than the French army, and very much more efficient than it is now. It seems certain that the German Air Force will continue to improve upon the long lead which it already has over us, particularly in respect of long-distance bombing machines. The year 1937 will certainly be marked by a great increase in the adverse factors which only intense efforts on our part can, to effective extent, countervail. The efforts at rearmament which France and Britain are making will not by themselves be sufficient. It will be necessary for the Western democracies, even at some extension of their risks, to gather round them all the elements of collective security or of combined defensive strength against aggression, if you prefer, as I do myself, to call it so, which can be assembled on the basis of the Covenant of the League of Nations. Thus, I hope, we may succeed in again achieving a position of superior force, and then will be the time not to repeat the folly which we committed when we were all powerful and supreme, but to invite Germany to make common cause with us in assuaging the griefs of Europe and opening a new door to peace and disarmament. I now turn more directly to the issues of this debate. Let us examine our own position. No one can refuse his sympathy to the Minister for the Coordination of Defence. From time to time, my right honourable friend lets fall phrases or facts which show that he realises, more than anyone else on that bench, it seems to me, the danger in which we stand. One such phrase came from his lips the other night. He spoke of the years that the locust hath eaten. Let us see which are these years that the locust hath eaten, even if we do not pry too closely in search of the locusts who have eaten these precious years. For this purpose we must look into the past. From the year 1932, certainly from the beginning of 1933, when Herr Hitler came into power, it was general public knowledge in this country that serious rearmament had begun in Germany. There was a change in the situation. 3 years ago, at the Conservative Conference at Birmingham, that vigorous and faithful servant of this country, Lord Lloyd, moved the following resolution: that this conference desires to record its grave anxiety in regard to the inadequacy of the provisions made for imperial defence. That was 3 years ago, and I see from the Times report of that occasion that I said, during the last 4 or 5 years the world had grown gravely darker. We have steadily disarmed, partly with a sincere desire to give a lead to other countries, and partly through the severe financial pressure of the time. But a change must now be made. We must not continue longer on a course in which we alone are growing weaker, while every other nation is growing stronger. The resolution was passed unanimously, with only a rider informing the Chancellor of the Exchequer that all necessary burdens of taxation would be cheerfully borne. There were no locusts there, at any rate. I am very glad to see the Prime Minister, Mr. Baldwin, restored to his vigour, and to learn that he has been recuperated by his rest, and also, as we hear, rejuvenated. It has been my fortune to have ups and downs in my political relations with him, the downs on the whole predominating, perhaps. But at any rate, we have always preserved agreeable personal relations, which, so far as I am concerned, are greatly valued. I am sure he would not wish, in his conduct of public affairs, that there should be any shrinking from putting the real issues of criticism which arise, and would certainly proceed in that sense. My right honourable friend has had all the power for a good many years, and therefore there rests upon him inevitably the main responsibility for everything that has been done or not done, and also the responsibility for what is to be done or not done now. So far as the heir is concerned, this responsibility was assumed by him in a very direct personal manner, even before he became Prime Minister. I must recall the words which he used in the debate of the 8th of March 1934, nearly 3 years ago. In answer to an appeal which I made to him, both publicly and privately, he said, "Any government of this country, a national government more than any, and this government, will see to it that in air strength and air power, this country shall no longer be in a position inferior to any country within striking distance of our shores." Well, sir, I accepted that solemn promise. But some of my friends, like Sir Edward Grigg and Captain Guest, wanted what the Minister for the Coordination of Defence, in another state of being, would have called further and better particulars, and they raised a debate after dinner, when the Prime Minister, then Lord President, came down to the House, and really showed less than his usual urbanity in chiding those members for even venturing to doubt the intention of the Government to make good in every respect the pledge which he had so solemnly given in the afternoon. I do not think that responsibility was ever more directly assumed in a more personal manner. The Prime Minister was not successful in discharging that task, and he admitted with manly candour a year later that he had been led into error upon the important question of the relative strength of the British and German air power. No doubt, as a whole, His Majesty's Government were very slow in accepting the unwelcome fact of German rearmament. They still clung to the policy of one-sided disarmament. It was one of those experiments, we are told, which had to be, to use a vulgarism, tried out, just as the experiments of non-military sanctions against Italy had to be tried out. Both experiments have now been tried out, and ministers are accustomed to plume themselves upon the very clear results of those experiments. They are held to prove conclusively that the policies subjected to the experiments were all wrong, utterly foolish, and should never be used again. And the very same men who were foremost in urging those experiments are now foremost in proclaiming and denouncing the fallacies upon which they were based. They have bought their knowledge, they have bought it dear, they have bought it at our expense, but at any rate let us be duly thankful that they now at last possess it. In July 1935, before the general election, there was a very strong movement in this House in favour of the appointment of a minister to concert the action of the three fighting services. Moreover, at that time, the departments of state were all engaged in drawing up the large schemes of rearmament in all branches, which have been laid before us in the White Paper, and upon which we are now engaged. One would have thought that that was the time when this new minister, or coordinator, was most necessary. He was not, however, in fact appointed until nearly 9 months later, in March 1936. No explanation has yet been given to us why these 9 months were wasted before the taking of what is now an admittedly necessary measure. The Prime Minister dilated the other night, no doubt very properly, the great advantages which had flowed from the appointment of the Minister for the Coordination of Defence. Every argument used to show how useful has been the work which he has done accuses the failure to appoint him 9 months earlier, when inestimable benefits would have accrued to us by the saving of this long period. When at last, in March, after all the delays, the Prime Minister eventually made the appointment, the arrangement of duties was so ill-conceived that no man could possibly discharge them with efficiency, or even make a speech about them without embarrassment. I have repeatedly pointed out the obvious mistake in organisation of jumbling together, and practically everyone in the House is agreed upon this, the functions of defence with those of a Minister of Supply. The proper organisation, let me repeat, is four departments: the Navy, the Army, the Air, and the Ministry of Supply, with the Minister for the Coordination of Defence over the four exercising a general supervision, concerting their actions, and assigning the high priorities of manufacture in relation to some comprehensive strategic conception. The House is familiar with the many requests and arguments which have been made to the Government to create a Ministry of Supply. These arguments have received powerful reinforcement from another angle in the report, the Royal Commission on Arms Manufacture. The first work of this new Parliament, and the first work of the Minister for the Coordination of Defence, if he had known as much about the subject when he was appointed as he does now, would have been to set up a Ministry of Supply, which should, step by step, have taken over the whole business of the design and manufacture of all the supplies needed by the Air Force and the Army, and everything needed for the Navy, except warships, heavy ordnance, torpedoes, and one or two ancillaries. All the best of the industries of Britain should have been surveyed from a general integral standpoint, and all existing resources utilised so far as was necessary to execute the programme. The Minister for the Coordination of Defence has argued, as usual, against a Ministry of Supply. The arguments which he used were weighty and even ponderous. It would disturb and delay existing programmes. It would do more harm than good. It would upset the life and industry of the country. It would destroy the export trade and demoralise finance at the moment when it was most needed. It would turn this country into one vast munitions camp. Certainly these are massive arguments, if they are true. One would have thought that they would carry conviction to any man who accepted them. But then, my right honourable friend went on somewhat surprisingly to say, the decision is not final. It would be reviewed again in a few weeks. What will you know in a few weeks about this matter that you do not know now, that you ought not to have known a year ago, and have not been told any time in the last 6 months? What is going to happen in the next few weeks which will invalidate all these magnificent arguments by which you have been overwhelmed, and suddenly make it worth your while to paralyse the export trade, to destroy the finances, and to turn the country into a great munitions camp? The First Lord of the Admiralty, in his speech the other night, went even farther. He said, "We are always reviewing the position. Everything," he assured us, "is entirely fluid." I am sure that is true. Anyone can see what the position is. The government simply cannot make up their minds, or they cannot get the Prime Minister to make up his mind. So they go on in strange paradox, decided only to be undecided, resolved to be irresolute, adamant for drift, solid for fluidity, all-powerful to be impotent. So we go on preparing more months and years, precious, perhaps vital to the greatness of Britain, for the locusts to eat. They will say to me, "A Minister of Supply is not necessary, for all is going well." I deny it. The position is satisfactory. It is not true. All is proceeding according to plan. We know what that means. Let me come to the Territorial Army. In March of this year, I stigmatised a sentence in the War Office memorandum about the Territorial Army, in which it was said the equipment of the Territorials could not be undertaken until that of the regular army had been completed. What has been done about all that? It is certain the evils are not yet removed. I agree wholeheartedly with all that was said by Lord Winterton the other day about the army and the territorial force. When I think how these young men who join the territorials come forward, almost alone in the population, and take on a liability to serve anywhere in any part of the world, not even with a guarantee to serve in their own units, come forward in spite of every conceivable deterrent, come forward 140,000 of them, although they are still not up to strength, and then find that the government does not take their effort seriously enough even to equip and arm them properly, I marvel at their patriotism. It is a marvel. It is also a glory. But a glory we have no right to profit by, unless we can secure proper and efficient equipment for them. A friend of mine the other day saw a number of persons engaged in peculiar evolutions, genuflections, and gestures in the neighbourhood of London. His curiosity was excited. He wondered whether it was some novel form of gymnastics, or a new religion. There are new religions which are very popular in some countries nowadays. Or whether they were a party of lunatics out for an airing. On approaching closer, he learned that they were a searchlight company of London territorials who were doing their exercises as well as they could, without having the searchlights. Yet we are told there is no need for a Ministry of Supply. In the manoeuvres of the regular army, many of the most important new weapons have to be represented by flags and discs. When we remember how small our land forces are, altogether only a few hundred thousand men, it seems incredible that the very flexible industry of Britain, if properly handled, could not supply them with their modest requirements. In Italy, whose industry is so much smaller, whose wealth and credit are a small fraction of this country's, a dictator is able to boast that he has bayonets and equipment for 8 million men. Halve the figure if you like, and the moral remains equally cogent. The army lacks almost every weapon which is required for the latest form of modern war. Where are the anti-tank guns? Where are the short-distance wireless sets? Where the field anti-aircraft guns against low-flying armoured aeroplanes? We want to know how it is that this country, with its enormous motoring and motor bicycling public, is not able to have strong mechanised divisions, both regular and territorial. Surely, when so much of the interest and the taste of our youth is moving in those mechanical channels, and when the horse is receding with the days of chivalry into the past, it ought to be possible to create an army of the size we want, fully up to strength, and mechanised to the highest degree. Look at the tank corps. The tank was a British invention. This idea, which has revolutionised the conditions of modern war, was a British idea forced on the War Office by outsiders. Let me say they would have just as hard work today to force a new idea on it. I speak from what I know. During the war, we had almost a monopoly, let alone the leadership, in tank warfare, and for several years afterwards we held the foremost place. To England all eyes were turned. All that has gone now. Nothing has been done in the years that the locust hath eaten to equip the tank corps with new machines. The medium tank which they possess, which in its day was the best in the world, is now looking obsolete. Not only in numbers, for there we have never tried to compete with other countries, but in quality, these British weapons are now surpassed by those of Germany, Russia, Italy, and the United States. All the shell plants and gun plants in the army, apart from the very small peacetime services, are in an elementary stage. A very long period must intervene before any effectual flow of munitions can be expected, even for the small forces of which we dispose. Still, we are told, there is no necessity for a ministry of supply, no emergency which should induce us to impinge on the normal course of trade. If we go on like this, and I do not see what power can prevent us from going on like this, some day there may be a terrible reckoning, and those who take the responsibility so entirely upon themselves are either of a hardy disposition, or they are incapable of foreseeing the possibilities which may arise. Now I come to the greatest matter of all, the heir. We received on Tuesday night from the First Lord of the Admiralty the assurance that there is no foundation whatever for the statement that we are vastly behindhand with our Air Force programme. It is clear from his words that we are behindhand. The only question is, what meaning does the First Lord attach to the word vastly? He also used the expression about the progress of air expansion that it was not unsatisfactory. One does not know what his standard is. His standards change from time to time. In that speech of the 11th of September about the League of Nations, there was one standard, and in the Hall of Al Pact there was clearly another. In August last, some of us went in a deputation to the Prime Minister in order to express the anxieties which we felt about national defence, and to make a number of statements which we preferred not to be forced to make in public. I personally made a statement on the state of the Air Force, to the preparation of which I had devoted several weeks, and which, I am sorry to say, took an hour to read. My right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, listened with his customary exemplary patience. I think I told him beforehand that he is a good listener, and perhaps he will retort that he learned to be when I was his colleague. At any rate, he listened with patience, and that is always something. During the 3 months that have passed since then, I have checked those facts again in the light of current events and later knowledge, and were it not that foreign ears listen to all that is said here, or if we were in secret session, I would repeat my statement here. And even if only one half were true, I am sure the House would consider that a very grave state of emergency existed, and also, I regret to say, a state of things from which a certain suspicion of mismanagement cannot be excluded. I'm not going into any of those details. I make it a rule, as far as I possibly can, to say nothing in this House upon matters which I am not sure are already known to the general staffs of foreign countries. But there is one statement of very great importance which the Minister for the Coordination of Defence made in his speech on Tuesday. He said, "The process of building up squadrons and forming new training units and skeleton squadrons is familiar to everybody connected with the Air Force. The number of squadrons in present circumstances at home today is 80, and that figure includes 16 auxiliary squadrons, but excludes the Fleet Air Arm, and of course does not include the squadrons abroad." End quote. From that figure, and the reservations by which it was prefaced, it is possible for the House, and also for foreign countries, to deduce pretty accurately the progress of our Air Force expansion. I feel, therefore, at liberty to comment on it. Parliament was promised a total of 71 new squadrons, making a total of 124 squadrons in the Home Defence Force by the 31st of March 1937. This was thought to be the minimum compatible with our safety. At the end of the last financial year, our strength was 53 squadrons, including auxiliary squadrons. Therefore, in the 32 weeks which have passed since the financial year began, we have added 28 squadrons. That is to say, less than one new squadron each week. In order to make the progress which Parliament was promised, in order to maintain the programme which was put forward as the minimum, we shall have to add 43 squadrons in the remaining 20 weeks, or over 2 squadrons a week. The rate at which new squadrons will have to be formed, from now till the end of March, will have to be nearly 3 times as fast as hitherto. I do not propose to analyse the composition of the 80 squadrons we now have, but the Minister in his speech used a suggestive expression, skeleton squadrons, applying at least to a portion of them. But even if every one of the 80 squadrons had an average strength of 12 aeroplanes, each fitted with war equipment, and the reserves upon which my right honourable friend dwelt, we should only have a total of 960 first-line home defence aircraft. What is the comparable German strength? I am not going to give an estimate and say that the Germans have not got more than a certain number, but I will take it upon myself to say that they most certainly at this moment have not got less than a certain number. Most certainly they have not got less than 1,500 first-line aeroplanes, comprised in not less than 130 or 140 squadrons, including auxiliary squadrons. It must also be remembered that Germany has not got in its squadrons any machine, the design and construction of which is more than 3 years old. It must also be remembered that Germany has specialised in long-distance bombing aeroplanes, and that her preponderance in that respect is far greater than any of these figures would suggest. We were promised most solemnly by the government that air parity with Germany would be maintained by the Home Defence Forces. At the present time, putting everything at the very best, we are, upon the figures given by the Minister for the Coordination of Defence, only about 2/3 as strong as the German Air Force, assuming that I am not very much understating their present strength. How, then, does the First Lord of the Admiralty, Sir Samuel Hoare, think it right to say, quote, "On the whole, our forecast of the strength of other air forces proves to be accurate. On the other hand, our own estimates have also proved to be accurate. I am authorised to say that the position is satisfactory." End quote. I simply cannot understand it. Perhaps the Prime Minister will explain the position. I should like to remind the House that I have made no revelation affecting this country, and that I have introduced no new fact in our air defence which does not arise from the figures given by the Minister and from the official estimates that have been published. What ought we to do? I know of only one way in which this matter can be carried further. The House ought to demand a parliamentary inquiry. It ought to appoint 6, 7, or 8 independent members, responsible, experienced, discreet members, who have some acquaintance with these matters and are representative of all parties, to interview ministers and to find out what are, in fact, the answers to a series of questions. Then to make a brief report to the House, whether of reassurance or of suggestion for remedying the shortcomings. That, I think, is what any Parliament worthy of the name would do in these circumstances. Parliaments of the past days, in which the greatness of our country was a building, would never have hesitated. They would have felt they could not discharge their duty to their constituents if they did not satisfy themselves that the safety of the country was being effectively maintained. The French Parliament, through its committees, has a very wide, deep knowledge of the state of national defence, and I am not aware that their secrets leak out in any exceptional way. There is no reason why our secrets should leak out in any exceptional way. It is because so many members of the French Parliament are associated in one way or another with the progress of the national defence that the French Government were induced to supply, 6 years ago, upward of £60 million sterling to construct the Maginot Line of fortifications, when our Government was assuring them that wars were over and that France must not lag behind Britain in her disarmament. Even now, I hope that members of the House of Commons will rise above considerations of party discipline, and will insist upon knowing where we stand in a matter which affects our liberties and our lives. I should have thought that the government, and above all the Prime Minister, whose load is so heavy, would have welcomed such a suggestion. Owing to past neglect, in the face of the plainest warnings, we have now entered upon a period of danger greater than has befallen Britain since the U-boat campaign was crushed. Perhaps, indeed, it is a more grievous period than that, because at that time at least we were possessed of the means of securing ourselves and of defeating that campaign. Now we have no such assurance. The era of procrastination, of half-measures, of soothing and baffling expedients, of delays, is coming to its close. In its place, we are entering a period of consequences. We have entered a period in which, for more than a year, or a year and a half, the considerable preparations which are now on foot in Britain will not, as the Minister clearly showed, yield results which can be effective in actual fighting strength, while during this very period Germany may well reach the culminating point of her gigantic military preparations, and be forced, by financial and economic stringency, to contemplate a sharp decline, or perhaps some other exit from her difficulties. It is this lamentable conjunction of events which seems to present the danger of Europe in its most disquieting form. We cannot avoid this period. We are in it now. Surely, if we can abridge it by even a few months, if we can shorten this period when the German army will begin to be so much larger than the French army, and before the British Air Force has come to play its complementary part, we may be the architects who build the peace of the world on sure foundations. Two things, I confess, have staggered me, after a long parliamentary experience, in these debates. The first has been the dangers that have so swiftly come upon us in a few years, and have been transforming our position and the whole outlook of the world. Secondly, I have been staggered by the failure of the House of Commons to react effectively against those dangers. That, I am bound to say, I never expected. I never would have believed that we should have been allowed to go on getting into this plight, month by month and year by year, and that even the government's own confessions of error would have produced no concentration of parliamentary opinion and force capable of lifting our efforts to the level of emergency. I say that unless the House resolves to find out the truth for itself, it will have committed an act of abdication of duty without parallel in its long history. End of speech. Recording by Ruth Golding.
How to Prevent War. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or how to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Speech given by Winston Churchill to the House of Commons, 24th March, 1938. The Prime Minister, in what I think it is not presumptuous for me to describe as a very fine speech, set before us the object which is in all our minds, namely, how to prevent war. A country like ours, possessed of immense territory and wealth, whose defenses have been neglected, cannot avoid war by dilating upon its horrors, or even by a continuous display of pacific qualities, or by ignoring the fate of the victims of aggression elsewhere. War will be avoided in present circumstances only by the accumulation of deterrents against the aggressor. If our defenses are weak, we must seek allies, and, of course, if we seek allies, alliances involve commitments. But the increase of commitments may be justified if it is followed by a still greater increase of deterrents against aggression. I was very glad to hear the Prime Minister reaffirm in such direct terms our arrangements for mutual defense with the French Republic. Evidently, they amount to a defensive alliance. Why not say so? Why not make it effective by a military convention of the most detailed character? Are we once again to have all the disadvantages of an alliance without its advantages, and to have commitments without full security? Great Britain and France have to stand together for mutual protection. Why should not the conditions be worked out precisely and the broad facts made public? Everyone knows, for instance, that our air force is tripled in deterrent effectiveness if it operates from French bases, and, as I pointed out in the House 3 weeks ago, the fact that an attack upon this country would bring the attacker into conflict with the French army is another great security to us here. We are obliged, in return, to go to the aid of France, and hitherto we have always been better than our word. Here, then, is the great security for the two countries. Do not conceal it. Proclaim it. Implement it. Work it out in thorough detail. Treat the defensive problems of the two countries as if they were one. Then you will have a real deterrent against unprovoked aggression, and if the deterrent fails to deter, you will have a highly organized method of coping with the aggressor. The present rulers of Germany will hesitate long before they attack the British Empire and the French Republic if those are woven together for defense purposes into one very powerful unit. Having gone so far, there is no safe halting place short of an open defensive alliance with France, not with loose obligations, but with defined obligations on both sides and complete interstaff arrangements. Even an isolationist would, I think, go so far as to say, if we have to mix ourselves up with the continent, let us, at any rate, get the maximum of safety from our commitments. The government acted in this sense, and a month later invited M. Daladier and M. Bonnet to London to discuss methods of concerting the defensive arrangements of the two countries. Then we come to the case of Czechoslovakia. There has been a lot of talk about giving a guarantee, but I should be sorry if the grave issue now open in Europe were to turn solely on that point, cardinal though it be. Far wider decisions are called for, far larger interests are at stake. I listened with the utmost attention to all that the Prime Minister said about our relations to Czechoslovakia, and it seems to me that he has gone a long way in making a commitment. First, I was very glad to hear him reaffirm his adherence and that of the government to the obligations of the Covenant of the League. Under the Covenant of the League, we are not obliged to go to war for Czechoslovakia. But we are obliged not to be neutral, in the sense of being indifferent, if Czechoslovakia is the victim of unprovoked aggression. The Prime Minister seemed to me to go farther than those mere obligations of the League, and to indicate how very real was the interest which we took in affairs in that part of the world. Lord Halifax, speaking in another place, used language which is particularly important coming from the head of the Foreign Office. He said he had asked Field Marshal Goring to repeat to him the assurances which he had given to the Prime Minister of Czechoslovakia, and that this had been done by the German government, and then Lord Halifax said, "By those assurances solemnly given and more than once repeated, we naturally expect the German government to abide, and if indeed they desire to see European peace maintained, as I earnestly hope they do, there is no quarter in Europe in which it is more vital that undertakings should be scrupulously respected. We not only have, therefore, the general obligations of the Covenant of the League, but we have this particular reference to special assurances given and received and noted. There is a third aspect. We have our agreement, which I have described, and of which the Prime Minister has reminded us, with France, and if France is attacked by Germany, for going to the rescue of Czechoslovakia, no one can say that we shall not be involved, not legally, not as a matter of bond, but by the force of events." The Prime Minister used language which undoubtedly had the effect of making it perfectly plain that the course of war, once started, could not be limited, that no one could tell what would happen, that other countries would be drawn in, and he mentioned especially France and Great Britain as two countries which might be involved. Taking all these points together, I cannot doubt that we have considerable commitments, and personally I am very thankful for any words that have been used which sustain that point of view. But this seems to be another case, if I may say so, of making very considerable commitments without gaining the full proportion of deterrent value. We are not taking the fullest steps in our power to stop the event occurring, and yet we are liable to suffer from it if it occurs. We are liable not only to be drawn in, but to be drawn in, perhaps, late in the day and very likely in unfavorable circumstances. It is really for consideration whether, having gone so far, the bolder course might not be the safer. All attempts to bridge a 12-foot stream by an 8-foot plank are doomed to failure, and the plank is lost. It is a concession, no doubt, to bring forward a 9-foot plank, but again, that may be lost. The great point in view is to achieve the object and to produce the effect of an adequate deterrent. The question does not turn upon an automatic permanent pledge. What I should be inclined to ask, if these matters could be at any time reconsidered, is not that a permanent or automatic pledge should be given, but that now, on this present occasion, in the circumstances which surround us at the moment, with the rape of Austria before our eyes, Great Britain should say, "If the Germans march in upon the state of Czechoslovakia without even waiting for an impartial examination, perhaps by a commission of the League of Nations or some other body, into the position of the Sudetendeutsche and the remedies offered for their grievances, if in those circumstances an act of violent aggression were committed upon that country, then we should feel on this occasion and in this emergency bound to act with France in resisting it." Such a declaration, although limited to this particular emergency, although limited until a tribunal has examined the position and until the negotiations now proceeding have reached their conclusion, such an assurance would, I believe, do a great deal to stabilize the position in Europe, and I cannot see that it would very seriously add to our risks. I must say that I myself have not felt during this crisis that there is an immediate danger of a major land war breaking out over Czechoslovakia. I know it is very rash to make such a statement, but when there is so much natural but misdirected alarm in the country, now on one's point and now on another, one must run some risks in stating one's honest opinion. At any rate, that is the assumption on which I base my argument this afternoon, and I will give my reasons to the House. The first reason is that, in the opinion of many good judges, Germany is not ready this year for such an ordeal as a major land war. The second reason carries more conviction to me, because obviously the first is based upon facts which one cannot measure and secrets which one cannot probe. It is that I cannot see that it would be to the interest of the rulers of Germany to provoke such a war. Are they not getting all they want without it? Are they not achieving a long succession of most important objectives without firing a single shot? Is there any limit to the economic and political pressure which, without actually using military force, Germany will be able to bring to bear upon this unhappy state? She can be convulsed politically, she can be strangled economically, she is practically surrounded by superior forces, and unless something is done to mitigate the pressure of circumstances, she will be forced to make continuous surrenders far beyond the bounds of what any impartial tribunal would consider just or right, until finally her sovereignty, her independence, her integrity have been destroyed. Why, then, should the rulers of Germany strike a military blow? Why should they incur the risk of a major war? Moreover, I think it is to be considered that there are other, even more tempting lines of advance open to Germany's ambitions. A serious disturbance among the Hungarian population in the Romanian province of Transylvania might offer a pretext for the entry of German troops at a Hungarian invitation or without it. Then all the possibilities of the oil and food of Romania would be open. Here again force may be avoided and virtual annexation may be veiled in the guise of a compulsory alliance. In the meantime, the control of Vienna enables the economic fortunes of all the states of the Danubian basin to be manipulated, exploited, and controlled so as to favor German designs and for the benefit of German finance, trade, and arms. Why, then, should Germany go to the one place where she would encounter the veto of France and of Russia, which has also made definite assurances? I do not think the government would have run very much risk if they had added the full force of Great Britain to the French declaration about Czechoslovakia. They would not greatly have increased their commitments, and they would have made assurance double sure. But the story of this year is not ended at Czechoslovakia. It is not ended this month. The might behind the German dictator increases daily. His appetite may grow with eating. The forces of law and freedom have for a long time known nothing but rebuffs, failures, and humiliations. Their influence would be immensely increased by any signs of concerted action and initiative and combination. The fact that Britain and France combined together at such a moment in such a cause would give them the strength and authority that they need in order to convince wavering states that they might find a good company of determined people to whom they might join themselves upon the basis of the covenant and in accordance with its principles. On the morrow of such a proof of unity as could be given between Great Britain and France, we might be able to make such an arrangement, or begin to make it, for the effective fulfillment of the covenant. We might have a group of powers, as it were, mandatories of the League, who would be the guardians of civilization, and once this was set up strong and real, it would liberate us, at least over a long period, from the torments of uncertainty and anxiety which we now have to endure. Joint action on this occasion would make easier and safer the problem of dealing with the next occasion. If successful, it would certainly pave the way to more effective joint action in the enforcement of the non-intervention policy in Spain. Nations that have joined together to meet one particular emergency may well find, when they look around, that they have assembled forces sufficient to deal with other emergencies not yet before us, and thus we may gather an ever-growing company, ranged under standards of law and justice, submitting themselves to principles that they are ready to enforce, and thus, by military and moral means combined, we may once more regain the ascendant and the initiative for the free peoples of the world and throughout the empire. Do not let anyone suppose that this is a mere question of hardening one's heart and keeping a stiff upper lip, and standing by to see Czechoslovakia pole-axed or tortured as Austria has been. Something more than that particular kind of fortitude will be needed from us. It is not only Czechoslovakia that will suffer. Look at the states of the Danube Basin. First and foremost, there is Yugoslavia. That is a most powerful and virile state, three-quarters of whose martial people are undoubtedly in the fullest sympathy with the democracy of France and Great Britain, and are animated by an ardent hatred of Nazi or fascist rule. They have a rooted desire to maintain themselves in their independence. Is nothing being done to ascertain what Yugoslavia would do, assuming that Great Britain and France were prepared to interest themselves in the problems of the Danube Basin? Yugoslavia might well be gained, and I am told that the effect of that on Bulgaria would probably be to draw her into the same orbit. Then there is Romania, so directly menaced by the potential German movement to the east. These three countries, if left alone and convinced that there is no willpower operating against the dictators, will fall one by one into the Nazi grip and system. What then will be the position of Greece and Turkey? I ask these questions hoping that they may be carefully considered. Is it not possible that decided action by France and Great Britain would rally the whole of these five states, as well as Czechoslovakia, all of whom have powerful armies, who together aggregate 75 million of people, who have several millions of fighting men already trained, who have immense resources, who all wish to dwell in peace within their habitations, who individually may be broken by defeat and despoiled, but who, united, constitute an immense resisting power? Can nothing be done to keep them secure and free, and to unite them in their own interests, in French and British interests, and above all in the interests of peace? Are we really going to let the whole of these tremendous possibilities fall away without a concerted effort of any kind? If we do, let us not suppose for a moment that we shall ourselves have escaped our perils. On the contrary, we shall have multiplied our perils for a very obvious reason. At present, Germany might contemplate a short war, but once she has laid hands on these countries and extended her power to the Black Sea, the Nazi regime will be able to feed itself indefinitely, however long war may last, and thus we may weaken the deterrent force against war of that blockade to which the honorable member who has just spoken referred. We should have removed another of the deterrents that stand between us and war. The Nazification of the whole of the Danube states is a danger of the first capital magnitude to the British Empire. Is all to go for nothing? Is it all to be whistled down the wind? If so, we shall repent in blood and tears our improvidence and our lack of foresight and energy. I have set the issue before the House in terms which do not shirk realities. It has been said by almost all speakers that, if we do not stand up to the dictators now, we shall only prepare the day when we shall have to stand up to them under far more adverse conditions. 2 years ago, it was safe. 3 years ago, it was easy. And 4 years ago, a mere dispatch might have rectified the position. But where shall we be a year hence? Where shall we be in 1940? In these next few months, all these substantial countries will be deciding whether they will rally, as they would desire to do, to the standards of civilization which still fly over Geneva, or whether they will be forced to throw in their lot and adopt the system and the doctrines of the Nazi powers. The Prime Minister spoke about the negotiations with Italy. I forbear to comment upon them, because I prefer to await the results when they are presented to us. I know no more effective means of aiding those negotiations than the creation of a Danubian bloc, and nothing that would make it more likely than any engagement entered into would bear fruit and be effective in the hour of serious need. I trust that the government will do their utmost. If it is too late, the evil is upon us, but do not let any chance be thrown away of endeavoring to save this great area from being overrun, exploited, and despoiled. I now come to the second aspect of the deterrence which we are assembling against aggression, namely national defense. I welcome very much the announcement that the Prime Minister has made in this respect, and particularly his decision to consult the trade unions. I know that he is averse from hasty decisions. No one can say that this is a hasty decision in the third year of rearmament. I was very glad also to hear the reassurance that drastic action will be taken to augment the speed of our air program, of our air raid precaution system, and of our anti-aircraft artillery. It is only a fortnight ago that my right honorable friend told us he was satisfied that we were making the best and the most effective use of our resources. However, it appears that there were other resources not being used, which now will be used in a greater effort. I regret very much that these additional resources have not been applied during the last 2 years, when the air program was seen to be trailing so far behind. Not only did we start 2 years too late, but the second 2 years have been traversed at only half speed. The Minister for the Coordination of Defense said a fortnight ago in rebuking me, "I detect in Mr. Churchill's demands a fundamental difference of opinion with the government, for he contemplates a great deal more interference with industry than has hitherto taken place." I was sorry to be told I was in fundamental difference with the government, and I am glad to know from the Prime Minister's statement that this particular fundamental difference is likely very soon to be removed. However, I must say I do not feel sure even now, after this latest decision, that the problem of rearmament is being dealt with on right lines. Is the method of organization to be employed adapted to a nationwide effort? Ought there not to be created, however tardily, a ministry of supply? Ought there not to be created a far more effective ministry of defense? Are there not problems pressing for solution which can be handled only by a minister of defense? Ought there not to be a Defense of the Realm Act, giving the necessary powers to divert industry, as far as may be necessary, from the ordinary channels of commerce, so as to fit our rearmament in with the needs of our export trade, and yet make sure that rearmament has the supreme priority? I will venture to echo the question which was posed by Mr. Amory last week. Is our system of government adapted to the present fierce, swift movement of events? 22 gentlemen of blameless party character, sitting round an overcrowded table, each having a voice, is that a system which can reach decisions from week to week and cope with the problems descending upon us and with the men at the head of the dictator states? It broke down hopelessly in the war. But is this peace in which we are living? Is it not war without cannon firing? Is it not war of a decisive character, where victories are gained and territories conquered, and where ascendancy and dominance are established over large populations with extraordinary rapidity? If we are to prevent this bloodless war being turned into a bloody war, ought not His Majesty's government to adopt a system more on a level with the period of crisis in which we live? Let me give a warning drawn from our recent experiences. Very likely this immediate crisis will pass, will dissipate itself, and calm down. After a boa constrictor has devoured its prey, it often has a considerable digestive spell. It was so after the revelation of the secret German Air Force. There was a pause. It was so after German conscription was proclaimed in breach of the treaty. It was so after the Rhineland was forcibly occupied. The House may recall that we were told how glad we ought to be because there would be no question of fortifying it. Now, after Austria has been struck down, we are all disturbed and alarmed, but in a little while there may be another pause. There may not, we cannot tell. But if there is a pause, then people will be saying, see how the alarmists have been confuted? Europe has calmed down, it has all blown over, and the war scare has passed away. The Prime Minister will perhaps repeat what he said a few weeks ago, that the tension in Europe is greatly relaxed. The Times will write a leading article to say how silly those people look who, on the morrow of the Austrian incorporation, raised a clamor for exceptional action in foreign policy and home defense, and how wise the government were not to let themselves be carried away by this passing incident. All this time, the vast degeneration of the forces of parliamentary democracy will be proceeding throughout Europe. Every 6 weeks, another corps will be added to the German army. At this time, important countries and great rail and river communications will pass under the control of the German General Staff. All this time, populations will be continually reduced to the rigors of Nazi domination and assimilated to that system. All this time, the forces of conquest and intimidation will be consolidated, towering up soon in real and not make-believe strength and superiority. Then presently will come another stroke. Upon whom? Our questions with Germany are unsettled and unanswered. We cannot tell. What I dread is that the impulse now given to active effort may pass away when the dangers are not diminishing, but accumulating and gathering as country after country is involved in the Nazi system and as their vast preparations reach their final perfection. For 5 years I have talked to the House on these matters, not with very great success. I have watched this famous island descending incontinently, fecklessly, the stairway which leads to a dark gulf. It is a fine broad stairway at the beginning, but after a bit the carpet ends. A little farther on there only flagstones, and a little farther on still, these break beneath your feet. Look back over the last 5 years. It is true that great mistakes were made in the years immediately after the war. But at Locarno we laid the foundation from which a great forward movement could have been made. Look back upon the last 5 years since, that is to say, Germany began to rearm in earnest and openly to seek revenge. If we study the history of Rome and Carthage, we can understand what happened and why. It is not difficult to form an intelligent view about the three Punic Wars, but if mortal catastrophe should overtake the British nation and the British Empire, historians 1,000 years hence will still be baffled by the mystery of our affairs. They will never understand how it was that a victorious nation, with everything in hand, suffered themselves to be brought low, and to cast away all that they had gained by measureless sacrifice and absolute victory. Gone with the wind. Now the victors are the vanquished, and those who threw down their arms in the field and sued for an armistice are striding on to world mastery. That is the position. That is the terrible transformation that has taken place bit by bit. I rejoice to hear from the Prime Minister that a further supreme effort is to be made to place us in a position of security. Now is the time at last to rouse the nation. Perhaps it is the last time it can be roused with a chance of preventing war, or with a chance of coming through to victory, should our efforts to prevent war fail. We should lay aside every hindrance and endeavor, by uniting the whole force and spirit of our people, to raise again a great British nation, standing up before all the world, for such a nation, rising in its ancient vigor, can even at this hour save civilization. End of speech. This recording by Aaron Elliott, St. Louis, Missouri.
The Annexation of Austria. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Ashwin Jain. Speech given by Winston Churchill to the House of Commons, 14th March 1938. The speech of the Prime Minister overshadows the debate and dominates all our minds. I do not know when in my lengthening experience of the House of Commons I have heard, certainly not since the war, a statement so momentous, expressed in language of frigid restraint, but giving the feeling of determination behind it. I am sure in all quarters of the House we heard with greatest pleasure his affirmation of the rights and interest and duty of Great Britain in Central Europe. He has said that there must be no hasty decision, and everybody will feel that while our minds are under the immediate influence of this painful and lamentable event, is not the best time to take fresh resolves, provided that nothing is lost by delay. I listened with great pleasure to the speech of the Honourable Member for Sprachbuch. I found myself ready to respond to the appeal which he made that we should pool our opinions and efface differences as far as possible. Above all, I agree with him in his statement that the policy should be declared within a reasonably short time by this country must be clear and precise, so that it can be understood for good or ill, countries and all parties. Everyone remembers the controversy which has dragged on for many years, about whether we could have stopped the Great War in 1914 if Sir Edward Grey had made plain declarations a week beforehand. I myself am of opinion that he did all that it was possible for him to do in the circumstances, and I doubt very much whether the event would have been averted even if he had made such a declaration. But still, there is a weight of historic judgment piling up that in all these matters of international strife and danger, it is most necessary that nations should declare plainly where they stand, and of all the nations which should so declare itself our country, with her insular characteristics still partially remaining to her, has an obligation to give a perfectly plain statement of what she will or will not do in certain contingencies, when those contingencies approach the threshold of reality. Long delay would be harmful. Why should we assume that time is on our side? I know of nothing to convince me that if the evil forces now at work are suffered to feed upon their successes and upon their victims, our tasks will be easier when finally we are all united. Not only do we need a clear declaration of the government's policy, but we require to set to work to rally the whole country behind the declared policy, in order that there may not be shifts and changes, as well as that there may not be any doubt or hesitation. It will certainly be no easier for us to face the problems with which we are confronted a year and hence than it is today. Indeed, we might easily delay resistance to a point where continued resistance and true collective security would become impossible. The gravity of the event of the 11th of March cannot be exaggerated. Europe is confronted with a program of aggression, nicely calculated and timed, unfolding stage by stage, and there is only one choice open, not only to us, but to other countries who are unfortunately concerned, either to submit, like Austria, or else to take effective measures, while time remains to ward off the danger and, if it cannot be warded off, to cope with it. Resistance will be hard, yet I am persuaded, and the Prime Minister's speech confirms me, that it is to this conclusion of resistance to overweening encroachment that His Majesty's government will come. The House of Commons will certainly sustain them in playing a great part in the effort to preserve the peace of Europe, and if it cannot preserve, to preserve the freedom of the nations of Europe. If we were to delay, if we were to go on waiting upon events for a considerable period, how much should we throw away of resources which are now available for our security and for the maintenance of peace? How many friends would be alienated? How many potential allies should we see go, one by one, down the grisly gulf? How many times would bluff succeed until behind bluff, ever-gathering forces had accumulated reality? Where shall we be 2 years hence? For instance, when the German army will certainly be much larger than the French army, and when all the small nations will have fled from Geneva to pay homage to the ever-waxing power of the Nazi system, and to make the best terms they can for themselves. We cannot leave the Austrian question where it is. We await the further statement of the government. But it is quite clear that we cannot accept as a final solution of the problem of Central Europe the event which occurred on March 11. The public mind has been concentrated upon the moral and sentimental aspects of the Nazi conquest of Austria, a small country brutally struck down, its government scattered to the winds, the oppression of the Nazi Party doctrine imposed upon a Catholic population, and upon the working classes of Austria and of Vienna, their hard ill usage of persecution, which indeed will ensue, which is probably in progress at the moment, of those who, this time last week, were exercising their undoubted political rights, discharging their duties faithfully to their own country. All this we see very clearly, but there are some things which I have not seen brought out in the public press, and which do not seem to be present in the public mind, and they are practical consideration of the utmost significance. Vienna is the center of all the communications of all the countries which formed the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, and all the countries lying to the southeast of Europe. A long stretch of the Danube is now in German hands. This mastery of Vienna to Nazi Germany, military and economic control of the whole communication of southeastern Europe, by road, by river, and by rail, what is the effect of it, what is called the balance of power, such as it is, and upon what is called a word about this group of powers called the Little Entente. Taken singly, the three countries of the Little Entente may be called powers of the rank, but they are very vigorous states, and united they are a great power. They have hitherto been, and are still, united by the closest military agreement. Together, they make the complement of a great power, and of the military machinery of a great power. Romania is the oil, Yugoslavia is for minerals and raw materials. Both have large armies. Both are mainly supplied with munitions from Czechoslovakia. To English ears, the name of Czechoslovakia sounds outlandish. No doubt they are a small democratic state. No doubt they have an army only 2 or 3 times as large as ours. No doubt they have a munition supply only 3 times as great as that of Italy. But still, they are a virile people. They have their treaty rights. They have a line of fortresses. And they have a strongly manifested will to live freely. Czechoslovakia is at this moment isolated, both in economic and in the military sense. Our trade outlet through Hamburg, which is based upon the peace treaty, can, of course, be closed at any moment. Now her communications by rail and river to the south, and after the south to the southeast, are liable to be severed at any moment. Her trade may be subjected to tolls of an absolutely strangling character. Here is a country which was once the greatest manufacturing area in the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. It is now cut off, or may be cut off at once, unless, out of these discussions which must follow, arrangements are made securing the communications of Czechoslovakia. You may be cut off at once from the sources of her raw material in Yugoslavia and from the natural markets which she has established there. The economic life of this small state may be practically destroyed as a result of the act of violence which was perpetrated last Friday night. A wedge has been driven into the heart of what is called the Little Entente. This group of countries which have as much right to live in Europe unmolested as any of us has a right to live unmolested in our native land. It would be too complicated to pursue the economic, military, and material reactions apart from moral sentiments altogether into the other countries. It would take too long, but the effects of what has happened now upon Romania, upon Hungary, upon Bulgaria, upon Turkey, must be the subject of the closest possible study, not only by His Majesty's government, by all who aspire to take part in the public discussion of these matters. By what has happened, it is not too much to say that Nazi Germany, in its present mood, if matters are left as they are, is in a position to dominate the whole of Southeast Europe, over an area inhabited by perhaps 200,000 of people, Nazism, and all that involves is moving on to absolute control. Therefore, I venture to submit to the House that this Nazi conquest of Austria cannot remain where it is, and that a patient, determined, a persevering discussion of it ought to take place and to be pushed forward. First of all, no doubt, through the chanceries and by the diplomatic channels, but also and ultimately it should be pushed forward in the natural place for such discussions at Geneva under the League of Nations. We are not in a position to say it tonight. The past is the past. We cannot say the past is the past without surrendering the future. Therefore, we await further statements from His Majesty's government with the greatest possible interest. The serious nature of our affairs is realized and apprehended in all parts of the House. I have often been called an alarmist in the past, yet I affirm tonight that there is still, in my belief, an honorable path to safety and, I hope, to peace. What ought we to do? The Prime Minister today has made a declaration upon the subject of defence. There is to be a new effort of national rearmament and national service. We shall have to lay aside our easy habits and methods. We shall have to concentrate on securing our safety with something like the intensity that has been practiced in other countries whose excesses we may desire to restrain. I think the House will be grateful to the Prime Minister for that declaration, and I am certain that he may rely upon all those strong forces in every part throughout the country to second the efforts of the government to place us in a position where we shall not feel ourselves liable to be blackmailed out of our duties, out of our interests, and out of our rights. It seems to me quite clear that we cannot possibly confine ourselves only to a renewed effort at rearmament. I know that some of the honorable friends on this side of the House will laugh when I offer them this advice. I say, laugh, but listen. I affirm that the government should express in the strongest terms our adherence to the covenant of the League of Nations and our resolve to procure by international action the reign of law in Europe. I agree entirely with what has been said by the leaders of the two opposition parties upon that subject, and I was extremely glad to notice that at the beginning and in the very forefront of his speech, the Prime Minister referred to the League of Nations and made that one of the bases of our right to intervene and to be consulted upon affairs in Central Europe. The matter has an importance in this country. There must be a moral basis for British rearmament and British foreign policy. We must have that basis if we are to unite and inspire our people and procure their wholehearted action, and if we are to stir the English-speaking people throughout the world. Our affairs have come to such a pass that there is no escape without running risks. On every ground of prudence as well as of duty, I urge His Majesty's government to proclaim a renewed, revivified, unflinching adherence to the covenant of the League of Nations. What is there ridiculous about collective security? The only thing that is ridiculous about it is that we have not got it. Let us see whether we cannot do something to procure a strong element of collective security for ourselves and for others. We have been urged to make common cause in self-defense with the French Republic. What is that but the beginning of collective security? I agree with that. Not so lightly will the two great liberal democracies of the West be challenged, and not so easily, if challenged, will they be subjugated. That is the beginning of collective security. But why stop there? Why be edged and pushed further down the slope in a disorderly, expostulating crowd of embarrassed states? Why not make a stand while there is still a good company of united, very powerful countries that share our dangers and aspirations? Why should we delay until we are confronted with the general landslide of those small countries passing over, because they have no other choice, to the overwhelming power of the Nazi regime? If a number of states were assembled around Great Britain and France in a solemn treaty for mutual defense against aggression, if they had their forces marshaled in what you may call a grand alliance, if they had their staff arrangements concerted, if all this rested, as it can honorably rest, upon the covenant of the League of Nations, in pursuance of all the purposes and ideals of the League of Nations, if that were sustained, as it would be, by the moral sense of the world, and if it were done in the year 1938, and believe me, it may be the last chance there will be for doing it, then I say that you might even now arrest this approaching war. Then perhaps the curse which overhangs Europe would pass away. Then perhaps the ferocious passions which now grip a great people would turn inwards and not outwards in an internal rather than an external explosion, and mankind would be spared the deadly ordeal towards which we have been sagging and sliding month by month. I have ventured to indicate a positive conception, a practical and realistic conception, and one which I am convinced will unite all the forces of this country, without whose help your armies cannot be filled or your munitions made. Before we cast away this hope, this cause, and this plan, which I do not at all disguise as an element of risk, let those who wish to reject it ponder well and earnestly upon what will happen to us if, when all else has been thrown to the wolves, we are left to face our fate alone. End of speech. Recording by Ashwin Jain.
At Ritual, we're celebrating all moms this Mother's Day, current and aspiring. So whether you're looking for fertility support, natal choline, or our best-selling clinically-backed prenatal, we've got you covered. Find your Ritual. Go to ritual.com/podcast and for a limited time, get 40% off your first month. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Based on net sales from industry data, including Nielsen IQ, Stackline, and Numerator as of Q4 2024 and top 5 products.